This is April 29th, 2018, and for Tayshia this morning, I'm going to talk about the what a huge priority convenience is in our country, and the dangers of letting it trump everything else in our lives. This is an article I'll be reading from in the New York Times called The Tyranny of Convenience. And this is by Tim Wu. Tim Wu, it tells us, is a law professor at Columbia and wrote a book called The Attention Merchants, The Epic Struggle to Get Inside Our Heads. And this article is dated February 16th of this year. And he starts strong. Convenience is the most underestimated and least understood force in the world today. As a driver of human decisions, it may not offer the illicit thrill of Freud's unconscious sexual desires or the mathematical elegance of the economist's incentives. Convenience is boring. But boring is not the same thing as trivial. In the developed nations of the 21st century, convenience, that is, more efficient and easier ways of doing personal tasks. More efficient and easier ways of doing personal tasks has emerged as perhaps the most powerful force shaping our individual lives and our economies. This is particularly true in America, where, despite all the paeans to freedom and individuality, one sometimes wonders whether convenience is in fact the supreme value. He quotes one of the co-founders of Twitter, Evan Williams, saying, "Convenience decides everything." And then the author here says, "Convenience seems to make our decisions for us, trumping what we like to imagine are our true preferences." And then he, in parentheses, he says, "I prefer to brew my coffee, but Starbucks instant is so convenient, I hardly ever do what I prefer. Easy is better. Easiest is best." Convenience has the ability to make other options unthinkable. Once you have used a washing machine, laundering clothes by hand seems irrational, even if it might be cheaper. After you've experienced streaming television, waiting to see a show at a prescribed hour seems silly, even a little undignified. To resist convenience, not to own a cell phone, not to use Google, has come to require a special kind of dedication that is often taken for eccentricity, if not fanaticism. Americans say they prize competition, a proliferation of choices, the little guy. Yet our taste for convenience begets more convenience through a combination of the economies of scale and the power of habit. So then he gives an example. The easier it is to use Amazon, the more powerful Amazon becomes, and thus the easier it becomes to use Amazon. Convenience and monopoly seem to be natural bedfellows. Given the growth of convenience as an ideal, as a value, as a way of life, it is worth asking what our fixation with it is doing to us and to our country. I don't want to suggest that convenience is a force for evil. Making things easier isn't wicked. On the contrary, it often opens up possibilities that once seemed too onerous to contemplate, and it typically makes life less arduous, especially for those most vulnerable to life's drudgeries. I ran across one of the other articles I picked out to read from this morning. Talks about it's in this article, excuse me. I got about three of them here. He'll get to that in just a minute. So it's not a force for evil. It opens up possibilities. Then he says, but we err in presuming convenience is always good, for it has a complex relationship with other ideals that we hold dear. Though understood and promoted as an instrument of liberation, convenience has a dark side. With its promise of smooth, effortless efficiency, it threatens to erase the sort of struggles and challenges that help give meaning to life. Created to free us, it can become a constraint on what we are willing to do, and thus, in a subtle way, it can enslave us. This is a important paragraph in this article that we're going to develop as we go on. He refers to it's promoted as an instrument of liberation. He develops that on the next page. He says that convenience was seen as the great liberator of humankind from labor. This was an utopian ideal. The thinking was, by saving time and eliminating drudgery, it would create the possibility of leisure. And with leisure would come the possibility of devoting time to learning, hobbies, or whatever else might really matter to us. Let's plug in sitting, daily sitting. Convenience would make available to the general population the kind of freedom for self-cultivation, there it is again, practice, once available only to the aristocracy. In this way, convenience would also be the great leveler. Back to that paragraph a minute ago, it's with its promise of smooth, effortless efficiency. So my main points this morning is to question whether effort is so bad. Effort, we know, everyone listening to this, I think, everyone who practices, who's practiced for more than a short time, knows that there are great fruits that come from effort, from working against, in the case of spiritual practice, working against our stubborn habit forces and not taking the path of least resistance. And he says that it threatens, convenience threatens to erase the sort of struggles and challenges that help give meaning to life. He goes on, the dream of convenience is premised on a nightmare of physical work. But is physical work always a nightmare? Do we really want to be emancipated from all of it? Perhaps our humanity is sometimes expressed in inconvenient actions and time-consuming pursuits. Again, sitting as one example. Perhaps this is why, with every advance of convenience, have always been those who resist it. They resist out of stubbornness, yes, and because they have the luxury to do so, but also because they see a threat to their sense of who they are, to their feeling of control over things that matter to them. Control, possibly a better word, is a sense of agency, that one has the freedom and the choice to act and not just be acted upon, to engage, I think is what I would have, the way I would put it. This point about how effort changes us, potentially for the better, if we do it with the best intention, we choose effort, but it's something that is, again, anyone who's practiced for any length of time knows the fundamental truth of this, that we only change through effort. There's no one has ever changed much by just sitting back. I mean, yes, suffering, unexpected suffering can change us, but that's a kind of effort. Adversity, for sure. There's an article I found about books. It's a New Yorker reviews of books about de Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, this legendary, very insightful Frenchman who came to the United States in 1831 and traveled around for, I think, 9 months, something like that, and writing down thousands and thousands of pages of notes about the creature of the American. And to this day, I've read many writers who acclaim him, his insights. And I picked out one here from one of those books. He says the following. He warns, that is, de Tocqueville warns, that modern democracy may be adept at inventing new forms of tyranny because radical equality could lead to the materialism of an expanding bourgeoisie and to the selfishness of individualism. And now the author of today's article, Wu, develops that more, the selfishness of individualism, whereby we turn away from collective political activity toward the cultivation of our own gardens. Still here, referring to de Tocqueville, in such conditions we might become so enamored with a, quote, relaxed love of present enjoyments, which of course is very much related to this cult of convenience, that we lose interest in the future and the future of our descendants, or in higher things, and meekly allow ourselves to be led in ignorance by a despotic force, all the more powerful because it does not resemble one. And then he quotes de Tocqueville, it does not break wills, and I think here, plug in convenience, it does not break wills, but it softens them, bends them, and directs them. It rarely forces one to act, but it constantly opposes itself to one's acting. It does not destroy, it prevents things from being born. Back to Tim Wu's article. Again, I left off, perhaps our humanity is sometimes expressed in inconvenient actions, and time-consuming pursuits. I have to say, I wonder about the effect of our live streaming, my Teishos and other talks here from the Zendo. I've heard from enough people who are very, very appreciative of it. I would put a lot of lot of stock in that coming from out-of-town people who have no chance to come to the center for a Sunday morning event. And because so many appreciate it, I have no intention of discontinuing our live streaming of these things. But I do wonder whether what the cost of it is. I mean, it's convenient. It's convenient to stay home, maybe in your jammies with a your coffee, the ubiquitous coffee, cup of coffee in your hand, and but there's something, clearly there's something lost when you don't come and engage with others, sit in this zendo, and actually the sitting that precedes Teisho or a talk is always part of it. It's really is part of the package, is the sitting together. And we live stream just sittings too, just morning and evening sittings. And so just the sitting, never mind the talk, but just the sitting together. And then if one stays after the Sunday morning talk for the brunch, where there's we engage with others, with the Sangha. The other day I ran across a definition of Sangha that it seems very much to the point. It's those who work toward liberation. To come and break bread or bagels with those who are working toward liberation. This is, how can we put a value on that? It's, we can't really turn back time. We're in it deep now with these devices and the many other things that give us convenience. But the point, a strong point I want to make this morning is not that we have to try to always pursue inconvenient ways of functioning, but that we should acknowledge, I think it's important to acknowledge, that it doesn't come without some kind of a price. There are things, intangible things, like I was just saying, the absence of effort develops character. It's so, it sounds so corny and such a commonplace to say that, but it's a profound truth. It's by working against resistance that we develop ourselves, we grow that way. I'll continue with his piece here. It's Tim Wu. He looks back and he says, by the late 1960s, the first convenience revolution had begun to sputter. The prospect of total convenience no longer seemed like society's greatest aspiration. Convenience meant conformity. The counterculture was about people's need to express themselves, to fulfill their individual potential, to live in harmony with nature rather than constantly seeking to overcome its nuisances. Playing the guitar was not convenient. Neither was growing one's own vegetables or fixing one's own motorcycle. Of course, he's referring to Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. But such things were seen to have value nevertheless, or rather, as a result, people were looking for individuality again. Perhaps it was inevitable then that the second wave of convenience technologies, the period we're living in, would co-opt this ideal. It would conveniencize individuality. You might date the beginning of this period to the advent of a Sony Walkman in 1979. With the Walkman, we can see a subtle but fundamental shift in the ideology of convenience. If the first convenience revolution promised to make life and work easier for you, the second promised to make it easier to be you. The new technologies were catalysts of selfhood. They conferred efficiency on self-expression. Consider the man of the early 1980s strolling down the street with his Walkman and earphones. He is enclosed in an acoustic environment of his choosing. He is enjoying, out in public, the kind of self-expression he once could experience only in his private den. A new technology is making it easier for him to show who he is, if only to himself. He struts around the world the star of his own movie. Of course, we see this all the time now, but just a slightly different technology. People moving around in public with their earbuds shut off, cut off, enclosed in their own environment of choice. So alluring is this vision that it has come to dominate our existence. Most of the powerful and important technologies created over the past few decades deliver convenience in the service of personalization and individuality. Think of the VCR, the playlist, the Facebook page, the Instagram account. This kind of convenience is no longer about saving physical labor. Many of us don't do much of that anyway. It is about minimizing the mental resources, the mental exertion required to choose among the options that express ourselves. Convenience is one-click, one-stop shopping, the seamless experience of plug-and-play. The ideal is personal preference with no effort. And he says that we're willing to pay a premium for convenience. In the 90s, Napster made it possible to get music online at no cost. A lot of people use that. He says, but though it remains easy to get music free, no one really does it anymore. Why? Because the introduction of the iTunes Store in 2003 made buying music even more convenient than illegally downloading it. And then he sums up, convenient beat out free. He makes a strong case for convenience being the number one value, even over saving money. As task after task becomes easier, the growing expectation of convenience exerts a pressure on everything else to be easy or get left behind. We are spoiled by immediacy and become annoyed by tasks that remain at the old level of effort and time. When you can skip the line and buy concert tickets on your phone, waiting in line to vote in an election is irritating. This is especially true for those who have never had to wait in lines, which may help explain the low rate at which young people vote. I think it's always been that way, that younger people are the least likely to have a feeling of efficacy in the democratic process and are least likely to vote, but I'm not sure. It's just what I seem to remember. Yeah, so this thing about waiting in line, I jotted down some potential costs of convenience, and one of those is patience. Just last week, someone sent me, emailed me, these words of Lao Tzu. Lao Tzu was, it literally means old master, the word Lao Tzu. He was this, the author of the Tao Te Ching. Is it a Taoist sage of the 6th century B.C. He was a contemporary of Confucius, said a lot of great things. There's a lot of Taoism in Zen. And Lao Tzu has a lot that we would agree with in Zen. But one thing he said that really struck me was the following: I have just three things to teach: simplicity, patience, compassion. These three things are our greatest treasures. So let's pick out one, patience, because the author here just mentioned patience. Patience or forbearance is considered one of the six qualities, the six perfections or paramitas in Buddhism, very important part of Buddhist doctrine. Patience or forbearance is it's an inestimable value to develop patience. I mean, really, it's very much at the heart of long-term practice. If we're impatient, if we remain impatient, we're not going to go far in this path. It demands patience, and it develops patience. Many of us may start Zen practice, and even for the first few years, have impatience that impedes our practice. But if we stick with it, we will become more patient. It's a huge, huge asset, a character trait that will get us very far in life. Patience are also the ability to delay gratification, the ability to control our impulses. We don't need to delay gratification with convenient devices and, well, with this culture of convenience. It's not just digital devices, but it's so many other things. We need less and less to delay any gratification. We need less and less to control our impulses. We just go online, we buy this or that. We no longer have to put up with boredom. As long as you've got a phone with a screen in your hand, you don't have to be bored. You're waiting in line, no problem. Just flee into your phone. Less and less do we have to cope with frustration or with failure. But these are the very things that we need to engage with, the need that we need to overcome, that we need to see through: boredom, frustration, failure, in order to develop ourselves. And it's crucial that we develop ourselves, because what we have to give to the world is who we are. And who we are is something we can work on, so that we might give more and more to others. Impulse control. I think of how incredibly easy it is now to access pornographic websites. I sometimes think, man, I wish I didn't have that to contend with. I'm glad I didn't have that to contend with when I was a teenager. How do you guys... I don't know how you... Sashin. Sashin is probably the most inconvenient thing in the universe. It's effort from beginning to end. It's why it makes adults out of us. Someone said to me in Doksan in the last Sashin, I feel like I'm becoming an adult. It's true. It's sort of the closest thing we have in Zen to a initiation rite, a rite of passage, where you become an adult, go from being a juvenile to becoming an adult, because you have to face boredom, frustration, and failure all the time. And you emerge from Sesshin stronger for it, fuller, more of a whole human being. Which is why people keep coming back to Sesshin. People who have been to Sesshin keep coming back, even though it's the most inconvenient thing in the world. Back to Lao Tzu. simplicity, patience, and compassion. Simplicity, there too. Sashin is about the most simple way you can imagine to live. It's people who go to Sashin are monks and nuns for a week. If you want to experience what monasticism is, but really experience it, go to Sashin. It's the height of simplicity. There's another article I ran across from a university periodical called the Pennsylvania Gazette. It's about a study that a religious studies professor by the name of Justin McDaniel did, where he invited students to participate in a course, part of which was living like monastics. I'll just pick out the salient parts of this. McDaniel's course had no exams or papers, but it was hard work. To pass, students were required at various points during the semester to forego music, technology, coffee, and physical contact with others. They had to wake up at 5 a.m. without an alarm and meditate several times a day. He had been involved for years in Buddhism, so you can see that here in this course outline. The restrictions were based on the practices of various monastic orders around the world. Students had to take a complete vow of silence, forego electronics, cook all their food from scratch, and manage on a budget of less than $50 a week. No sexual activity was allowed. The only way students were able to communicate with friends and family was by writing letters, the old-fashioned way. Now, the upshot of all this is that the people, these ones who stuck it out, said it was the happiest. They quote one person as saying it was the happiest I had ever been in my life. She said, I literally couldn't have a bad day. They were also meditating. It's very important. I didn't mention that. I love these words of William Morris, not the advertising guy, but he was a 19th century English poet, artist, architect, and designer. And he said, simplicity of life, even the barest, is not misery, but the very foundation of refinement. That's Sashin is a refining process. And Zazen is, more broadly speaking, Zazen is. But you experience it more dramatically in Sashin, more powerfully. What other potential costs of convenience? Things, trade-offs. We mentioned about work. The point of this article and the point of this Taisho is not to say we should stop using conveniences. I think we just can't. We can't. That thing has passed. But let's at least be aware of what we might be sacrificing by always turning to what is most convenient. Including relationships, it can be so much more convenient to do things on screen. People, every once in a while, someone asks if I'll give Doksan by Skype. And that's not, I mean, it's not a bad idea. I've seriously considered it, but I just think something is lost. Okay, granted, you can make the case it's better than nothing, but if I had far fewer students, a lot more time on my hands, I might do it because it would become a lot of people would want that. But it's just not the same as being face to face with someone. And same thing with family, interactions with families. Yes, it's convenient to use these devices to stay in touch, but it can't compare to what one author said, it can't compare to sustained physical proximity. Same with parenting. One's children, yes, you're in contact with them, but how can that compare to actual physical presence? Back to Lao Tzu's third one, we covered simplicity and patience, and then the third is compassion. This is the third of these things he calls our greatest treasures. And there's so much research, I don't have time to find the articles I've read, so much research that shows that there's been an alarming drop in empathy among people as a result of these convenient devices. Empathy is very much like compassion. But back to the article. Last thing I said was convenient, beat out, free. As task after task becomes easier, the growing expectation of convenience exerts a pressure on everything else to be easy or get left behind. Oh, I already read that. Next paragraph. The paradoxical truth I'm driving at is that today's technologies of individualization are technologies of mass individualization. Customization can be surprisingly homogenizing. Everyone, or nearly everyone, is on Facebook. It is the most convenient way to keep track of your friends and family, who in theory should represent what is unique about you and your life. Yet, Facebook seems to make us all the same. Its format and conventions strip us of all but the most superficial expressions of individuality, such as which particular photo of a beach or mountain range we select as our background image. Full disclosure, I don't know anything about this because I still feel no need to get on Facebook. And I read a lot of reasons to not get on Facebook in terms of how it complicates your life and the anxiety. This I covered in at least one other Chase show about the research that has been shown how much anxiety, especially young people, suffer as a result of being on Facebook and all the crap that happens on Facebook. He continues, I do not want to deny that making things easier can serve us in important ways, giving us many choices of restaurants, taxi services, open source encyclopedias, where we used to have only a few or none. But being a person is only partly about having and exercising choices. This is very important. This is one of the themes of the chant we do called Affirming Faith in Mind. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose when preferences are cast aside. There's a saying in German that rings so true. Wer die Wahl hat, hat die Qual. Whoever has choice has pain. This is the unique pain of the 21st century that so many of us have, is just being confronted with so many choices, consumer choices, that can drain us of so much time trying to find the perfect choice. Being a person is only partly about having and exercising choices. It is also about how we face up to situations that are thrust upon us, about overcoming worthy challenges and finishing difficult tasks, the struggles that help make us who we are. what happens to human experience when so many obstacles and impediments and requirements and preparations have been removed. Character. We're talking about character, developing character. Now, the problem is that convenience is so enticing that it's hard to choose adversity. And so people will do what they want, but as long as we recognize that there's a price we pay. And if you, here's one way to consider it, that as long as everything in our life is going along pretty well, then there's no reason not to do everything in the most convenient way possible. But then when we are confronted with sickness, old age, and yes, death, sickness, old age, and death, this is when, without some fiber, some character, without the strength that we've developed by through overcoming adversity, then we will be lost. It's not the strongest reason to choose the inconvenience of struggle, because it's forward, it's future-oriented. Okay, I want to be prepared for sickness, old age, and death. But it is a reason, important reason. But for most people, it doesn't become important until they're in the throes of sickness, old age, or death. He continues, today's cult of convenience fails to acknowledge that difficult is a constitutive feature of human experience. Convenience is all destination and no journey. But climbing a mountain is different from taking the tram to the top, even if you end up at the same place. We are becoming people who care mainly or only about outcomes. We are at risk of making most of our life experiences a series of trolley rides. Every once in a while you hear about some new meditation device or meditation path that promises that you can, through technology, you can reach what they claim could be enlightenment. Even if that were true, and I use the subjunctive, even if it were true, what about everything that you're missing through the struggle? All right. Convenience has to serve something greater than itself, lest it lead only to more convenience. In her 1963 classic, The Feminine Mystique, Betty Friedan looked at what household technologies had done for women and concluded that they had just created more demands. She wrote, "Even with all the new labor-saving appliances, the modern American housewife probably spends more time on housework than her grandmother did." And then the author says, "When things become easier, we can seek to fill our time with more easy tasks. At some point, life's defining struggle becomes the tyranny of tiny chores and petty decisions. An unwelcome consequence of living in a world where everything is, quote, easy, is that the only skill that matters is the ability to multitask. At the extreme, we don't actually do anything. We only arrange what will be done, which is a flimsy basis for a life." He says we need to consciously embrace the inconvenient. Not always, but more of the time. Nowadays, individuality has come to reside in making at least some inconvenient choices. You need not churn your own butter or hunt your own meat, but if you want to be someone, you cannot allow convenience to be the value that transcends all others. Struggle is not always a problem, Sometimes struggle is a solution. It can be the solution to the question of who you are. Embracing inconvenience may sound odd, but we already do it without thinking of it as such. As if to mask the issue, we give other names to our inconvenient choices. We call them hobbies, avocations, callings, passions. These are the non-instrumental activities that help to define us. In other words, activities we do for their own sake, not just in order to acquire something or reach some future goal. They reward us with character because they involve an encounter with meaningful resistance, with nature's laws, with the limits of our own bodies, as in carving wood, melding raw ingredients, fixing a broken appliance, writing code, timing waves, or facing the point when the runner's legs and lungs begin to rebel against her. Such activities take time, but they also give us time back. They expose us to the risk of frustration and failure, but they also can teach us something about the world and our place in it. So let's reflect on the tyranny of convenience. Try more often to resist its stupefying power and see what happens. We must never forget the joy of doing something slow and something difficult. The satisfaction of not doing what is easiest. The constellation of inconvenient choices may be all that stands between us and a life of total, efficient conformity. This one passage, this phrase, doing something slow and something difficult, the satisfaction of not doing what is easiest. I say at every workshop, or almost every workshop, I say anything of enduring value takes time. Could also say it takes patience, it takes effort, takes perseverance. So I would conclude by saying, even if you go with every possible convenience you possibly can, at least keep sitting. Stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.